What are the three philosophical lines of investigation that these three schools embody?
Yeah, Ryan. Well, again, I think PG would have a lot more to add to it, but I would hold that the Black relies more on what you'd call absolute skepticism. And this bleeds into the Yellow School. And then there's the White, which accepts the skepticism, but says, hey, the glass can be half full or the glass can be half empty. So let's have a good time anyways.
I think the scientist is automatically skeptical. The scientist says every conclusion can be retested and retested with new information, and no, new conclusions can be formulated therefrom. So skepticism is something more to the White school than I think to the Black and Yellow school. But the intended answer there is, and why, what Q, I was hoping you'd grab there, Ryan, monism, dualism, and nihilism. Those are what Crowley says the three schools are. Though Crowley will say that the nihilism doesn't belong to either of the three schools. He says nihilism is, is a definition by Nietzsche, and that's all he says on it. You know, and it's just a futile ridiculousness that Nietzsche gets around easily enough. I say that any time that you involve yourself in a monogrammatic universe, such as the Yellow School postulates, and you say that this world is an illusion and that the ideal forms are in another world, then you have a problem unless you say that this world is evolving to that perfection.
Would those be the otherworldly types? Because Christians are known for being not of this world, because they say, like, this world doesn't really matter because they're getting ready for the next life.
And that's the mistake. I would say that the White school postulates this world is imperfect, but we are evolving to perfection. Why do we know that? Because we can conceive of an ideal world. We can conceive of a perfect circle, a perfect square, a perfect triangle, to echo Pythagoras. And because we can conceive of it, we can begin to build it. We can conceive of a perfectly functioning mind and a perfectly healthy body. So we're developing medicines that are going to extend our lifetime, maybe just short of immortality.
But this leads into my question about Judaism. The Jews have a half, and I was always wondering where they would fall in this. And I always kept thinking on one level the White school, because their main impulse is always changing and complaining and making noise in this world to make it better. Of course, there are many Black elements in it as well, because the three schools transcend religion.
Right.
But the idea of a messiah, the idea of atonement and everything being rectified on the earth, original Judaism not even having an afterlife or a separate world other than this one.
The imperfection in the Jewish ontology is caused by a sin of Adam disobeying God's commandment to not eat that stupid apple.
So they're striving to get back to a place where earth is reconciled with heaven.
Yeah, and the Hebrew Kabbalah is all about reconciling. We've got to reconcile every last little part of the body until finally, God forgive us and let us be perfect again.
Yeah, I know. It gets pretty ridiculous. But the general impetus there does seem pretty White school for the most part.
But again, their culture gets in the way. Because too many of them that take their history as literal instead of as a denotative.
But that's where I see a division between the Black brothers and the Black school. I see, again, if we go to the 12th ether in the vision of the voice, the Black brothers, are given in the Jewish metaphor. There are those that were unwilling to use their own blood to seal the doors against death. They had to use somebody else's blood. And you see this manifesting in the Jewish addiction to the past. They have to relive the past. Their ego is cemented to the egos of the past. And there is a strain of Black Brotherhood going on there. Now, of course, you identify the Black Brothers completely with the Black School. I'm not entirely sure.
I do not identify with the Black Brothers with the Black School at all. Oh, no, I'm sorry. I do. Forgive me. I do not identify the Black School with the Black Lot. I think...
But the Black Brothers shut themselves up, remember. They are shutting themselves up from the life force. They refuse to give their blood to the cup of Babylon. They want to keep their egos, as Crowley says in his footnote, to the 12th ether. And that was when he was referring to the reference to the Jews given that ether.
There's a difference between the Black School and the Black Lodge and the Black Brothers as well.
Yes. The Black Brothers are of the Black School. They're our brothers. The Yellow School and the Black School are brothers of the White School. At the table of adepts, all three sit together and have a good time.
But the Black Lodge is something completely else than the Black Brothers.
Going out of order in our questions, but it's a perfect thing to do here. What is the Black Lodge? First of all, it's not an actual lodge, and it is composed of no people at all. Okay? Rather, it is an egregore of cognitive dissonance, egoism, the false lower egos that we all have, that is the natural human state, unmodified by education and other things. And in that, a projection goes out that creates the cognitive dissonance that we can all happily live in our blindness and our ignorance. Ignorance is bliss. And this is the Black Lodge. And for people that hold up that cognitive dissonance as a virtue, we can call them dupes of the Black Lodge.
But that sounds like the Black Brother, because Crowley even says the Black Brother is like a guy who's using a boomerang, even though everybody else is using a rifle in a battle. And he says that whenever he talks about the Black Brothers. They've shut themselves up from evolution. They've used all their magic abilities just to keep their ego the same, to keep the same thing over and over, as opposed to letting it transform.
Yes.
And of course, it changed. And they eventually die from their own entropy because they've cut themselves off from the life force. The ego can only last for so long.
But I'm going to look at it altogether differently. The Black School is all about antagonism to the White School. Why? Very simple. The Black School really feels that the superstitious path is a valid path. Okay? In other words, the fact that, you know, they're going to decry Jesus saves all over the place and Jesus loves you, they're going to make a virtue out of this. You're going to get your people in there on Sundays singing those hymns with excitement and glee. They're going to dance in another church and drink the poison until they don't get killed by the poison because they're dancing so feverishly, you know, doing sort of a tarantelle. The Black Lodge is antagonistic to the White Lodge. The White Lodge is going to come out and the Black Brothers, rather, to the White Brothers. The White Brothers are going to come out and say, listen, science starts to change our knowledge. We can see already that the Earth goes around the sun. Your superstition doesn't work in the real world. And the Black Lodge is going to insist that it does. It's even better than doing anything else. Okay? Because faith and belief move mountains. Right? Get everyone to the cause.
The Black Brothers, as Crowley defines them, fall into the Black Lodge at some point. I mean, they get consumed by the Kreefog. They become the shells.
But so can the White Lodge. So can the Yellow Lodge, the White School and the Yellow School. We could all fall into that pit of superstition. It's very easy to do. I mean, we've got people in Thelema that are convinced that Rahor Kuwait's a real god sitting on the throne, and a horse is really up there.
Yeah, there are, and Thelema has been accused of being an elitist philosophy, but to contrast with Judaism, there's no, they don't care if you're, you know, with a philosophy, it doesn't matter what your blood is, your parents, or is sectarianism, like, are you Ashkenazi or Sephardic, and so on. It's basically universal philosophy.
Yeah.
The other thing is the Jews make it almost impossible to become a Jew. They really don't encourage other people to become Jews. It's almost the opposite of looking for converts.
Well, because
where you have the OTO who wants anybody and everybody to be a member.
Because it upset them. Conversion upsets the Jews. They want you to be reborn into Judaism. They're the most noble race on earth. Okay, so those born into that race are already a step ahead of everyone else, and everyone else is just working so that they can be reborn a Jew. That's the Jewish perspective.
Yeah.
So don't convert.
God's chosen people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't convert. Just be, live a good life, and when you die, you'll become a Jew in your next life.
And you'll be born with a condominium and a sports car. You know?
Right.
First, my condominium and sports car.
Oh, my gosh.
The interesting thing about the Hebrew Kabbalah, as I've been learning, it's been a real experience. I started watching two different Kabbalah programs, and though they're vastly different in approach, they're saying the same thing. If you look at the Kabbalah Center being run by Rabbi Berg, it's all about happiness in this life, and the Kabbalah is going to be the new age tool to make you happy and successful and fulfilled. So it's really taking on a mass appeal, whereas the other Kabbalah group that I'm watching, which really has no name, but it's operated out of Israel. They're going to talk about the same exact ideas, but they're not going to put it in the New Age fulfillment context. But they are – essentially, both are saying this. The light pours down into us who are vessels. It will be retained by those of us who are complete vessels. The others are incomplete vessels. The complete vessel is called Kli, and the incomplete or fractured vessel is called Klifa. So in this, you bear a certain shame, a certain natural shame, which is the mystery of original sin, because I want fulfillment, and therefore I am somehow committing an unvirtuous act, because I am accepting that light. So to be virtuous, I'm going to first reject it. Then I'm going to find out that I'm empty, and I need to accept it, but I need to learn to pass that light on then to others. And, of course, the only ones most deserving of that is Jews, because they're the chosen race. Okay? So I extend that light to others by acts of beneficence. You know, and I give up all my things that I like to them, as they give all the things they like to me, and we just constantly keep giving back and forth to each other, so we're passing on the light. And then there's this whole synergy going that goes into the whole Kabbalism thing, and they're all gonna take it from some moralistic perspective. Because all you can do is be righteous in front of God. You know, because you're just a piece of clay, a vessel. This, when we take the Jewish elements out of Kabbalah, we see the light pouring into the vessels that are 10 of them together, that each come down to finally manifestation in our body, which receives that light from heaven. God comes into man, and man goes into God. And so, without the false morality, we can take the Kabbalah in a much more practical sense. For those of us that are mystically inclined and can see more than what goes on this earth, can see more than an anthropomorphic God that simply needs to have its dick sucked once in a while. The Jews, in essence, reveal and then pervert, distort, and hide. So, I mean, that's certainly a Black Lodge idea. being expressed with a high level of intelligence as compared to the Christians, they're just going to go believe in Jesus or die. So, when we get down to a greater conception of the Kabbalah that is not interrupted by culture, we can see the ontology of the universe and its cosmogony unfolding in a realistic way. And this is what Blavatsky gave back to us, that we in the white school had essentially forgotten. Okay, and that's what the secret doctrine is all about. How the one becomes the two becomes the many. You know, going from one to two to seven, etc. And
right.
And we get, this is how we develop our universal hierarchies, our seven sacred gods, which are the seven sacred planets, etc., etc. And from there now, we have a natural development of from the Ein Sof to Malkut. And we get a much clearer conception of what we're doing here. I'm not trying to get back to the Godhead. I'm not saying, oh, my life is essentially sorrow, so I should annihilate my ego, and when I die, I'll just be nothing again. And that would be happiness. Now, in Thelema, we're saying that's still a valid path. There are
but
those
life is suffering. It's just that not all suffering is bad or evil. No pain, no gain, or something.
Thelema says all that suffering is but a key to the next step, your joy.
Yeah. It's it makes the joy that much greater.
Well,
I had an overeducated snob say, like, okay, so the happiness of getting a new car is the same as wrapping that car around a tree. Now I know what you meant, Gibran.
I think of it like this way. I can't enjoy really going for a piss unless I've held it for a long time. You know when you have that discomfort you've been holding, and then when you go, it's one of the best pleasures in the world.
But of course, Venus.
Think about when you're working really hard for a math exam, maybe even failed one of them before, and you're working hard and you're really producing blood, sweat, and tears, and eventually you ace it. The ecstasy is divine.
Guys, you're missing it. The whole point of all of this. Veena teaches us the mystery of sorrow is joy.
Yeah.
There is no difference. Okay, let's look at it this way. The Godhead is non-differentiated consciousness. It differentiates into singularities, each one of us becoming a monad, okay, that we would interact with each other and have pastimes. Okay, and this is the pleasure of God, or of the universal mind. And so the guy being tortured in a Latin American prison cell is God enjoying itself. Indeed, one of the mysteries of Christianity is the agony and the ecstasy. In the agony, in the final agony of torture, comes in the most amazing ecstasy. And torture victims will tell you of that.
PJ, are you willing to be tested on this?
Yep, Paul.
I got some pliers. I'm heating them red hot right now.
Wait, PJ, what are you talking about, this ecstasy of torture or something?
Well, in the throes of the agony comes an ecstasy. The mind gets to a wild state. We see it to a lesser degree in long-distance runners. After the exhaustion gets transcended, you know, and they get to this real high spiritual place.
Well, BDSM practitioners say that it's called headspace when they get to that. It's like a high. And tattoos, too, they get an endorphin rush.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I had my septum pierced, I remember being really fucking high.
Yeah.
I don't think I've been that high before, actually. Other than when I was whipped on the back of the phone cable. But that's another story.
Uh-huh.
Ryan, sometimes we wonder about you. I don't know. So, it's like the yin yang. Inside of the deepest part of agony is ecstasy, and inside of the deepest part of ecstasy is agony.
I don't know. You never have me admit, that this, pain should be craved because it gives pleasure or whatever. I just think that they both spring from passion.
Guys, I will admit one thing. Whenever I've stubbed my toe or, accidentally injured myself, I would make a samadhi on the pain and I could experience joy. The problem is with long-term pain, it takes tremendous energy and ability to maintain the samadhi on that pain. And then you can lapse into the regular mundane consciousness, which isn't able to experience that joy, which is really latent inside the pain. But I've been able to laugh at my pain a few times by just concentrating my mind on the pain.
And what's to the level of maturity? It is the distribution of pain that matures us to a greater ecstasy in life. Yeah. Otherwise, we become spoiled rotten, right?
It feels pretty good when you break up with a bad person or get, an unhealthy friend out of your life.
Yeah. So the two sides of the same coin, and I must experience one to know the other. So you begin to access the mystery of sorrow equals joy. You know, long journey from there to the final realization of that sorrow, which would be, the crossing of the abyss and landing in the city of the pyramid.
Yeah, somehow I haven't felt this bad. I haven't felt this much agony and sorrow for a long, long, long time, maybe 10 years or something, or maybe more than that. I don't know if I've ever felt this much agony. But in those tears and in those heartaches, it has. I just start to feel very cheerful at the same time, and somehow a lot of joy comes out of that. It's hard to explain, but it's like deepest down in all that agony. There's super much lightness and just feeling calm and happy and loving life. Somehow.
So we see here your beginning apprehension of the mystery of sorrow equals joy, of being in itself. There's a long road till you finally cross the abyss and land in the city of the pyramid. But you begin to access an intimation of what's ahead of you. In the same way, I began thinking of my own what is diagnosed as a bipolarity. And all artists and all salesmen have it, and I'm both an artist and a salesman, so fuck me.
So that would make you a bullshit artist.
Well,
that's what my friend Art calls me, so it's bullshit.
But in that, I find depths of despair, and I find moments of exquisite ecstasy. And I have to learn in my life that I need both. The despair is the loss of the creative tool because I'm taking in now. And I must absorb and reflect and pull new material into me that I can re-express in an ecstatic intrusion. In much the same way as a salesman, I'm constantly getting no, 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 till I finally get that yes and get the big bucks.
Yeah.
And then I'm buying everyone drinks at the bar. So it is indeed something that is a part of the creative process, and of course the creative process is our evolutionary process. It is through creativity that we evolve, whether that's the creativity of the arts or the creativity of the sciences, or the creativity of our cells, and each of these living mitochondria creating all sorts of differentiation and building our evolution.
Hmm.
And that's I'll dare say is a radical concept, but a valid concept. We see it echoed inside of the Star Wars theme with the Force.
I just happened to be reading something on the web earlier today. Some people are asserting, and not Christians in the Christian way, but spiritual people are beginning to assert that the Darwin theory of evolution is flawed. You know, it presupposes too much. And I say, not necessarily. If we forget for a moment presumption that we are living entirely in our own minds and realize that the thoughts in our minds are the product of our whole body's experience, and that these mitochondria are the ones doing all the work. You know, the two strands of DNA that start at the moment of our conception, it's just one cell. There's something inside of that cell that's moving that cell both through the mitotic process of splitting two cells. But then as each of those two cells split and split and split and split, heart, brain, liver, skin, bones, teeth, nose, eyes, okay, the different organs of the body begin to access. And so therefore there is an awareness that we've not yet become aware of as humanity. We're still too caught up in the presumption that we are entirely our minds. And we forget that there's a mind in each cell of our bodies. And this is what I think the supermental yogis have figured out. And why I've been so interested in the mother's tome.
We talked about that, PJ, on the list several years ago about memories of the body, like, you know, if you have spasms or your arm or your leg just wants to do something that you used to do so often in the past, you know?
Like, yeah, there's a body mind.
Unconscious gestures or movements, out of habit.
Yeah.
Well, it's like when you're trying to learn a new language and you know how to say it in your mind, but your lips won't say it.
Yeah. So the body becomes the receptacle of the feed from the body, and we call that emotions, because that's how the mind interprets it. And then the mind needs an intellect to then evaluate the emotion. But we're always moved by the emotions first. And then we rationalize. And so that becomes important, and then what becomes more important is that we begin to listen to the cells of our body, and indeed, as the supermental yogis would tell you, we have to access each one of those cells and bring them to full consciousness, that they'll participate with the mind as its organizing center.
So there's a dichotomy with the mind. Science says that, you know, you should be able to prove something as existing outside of yourself empirically, but there are things like love and emotions that only exist inside of us. You can observe the results of them on the outside, but they're, you know, they don't exist outside of ourselves.
Well, you know, this goes back to what I said of the Black Lodge earlier. And remember, science is said to have betrayed the White Lodge. The Black Lodge is concerned with the outer world and sees no connection between the outer world and the inner world. Indeed, the Black Lodge doesn't care about the inner world. Everything out in the world is where reality is set. And therefore, if you are a person of mind, whether that be a spiritualist, an artist, whatever, a sensualist, all these things are evil, and Christians deny themselves, because it's our eternal experience. You know, all they see is, you out in the world are having internal experiences. You are an evil person. Okay, let's get the crusade and let's go after that guy. And hence, the yellow press is born in America.
Well, the Black School, I think, is concerned with saying there's an absolute reality. On the other hand, if you take a scientific approach and you try to prove that there's an objective reality that we can all somewhat agree on, aside from our, subjective interpretation of our senses or our prejudices or whatever. If you like deny that, then basically everything is arbitrary and relative.
Yeah, well, it's a consensus.
And there's nothing really matters in that sense then. if it's all up to you, you know, up to interpretation.
It's funny, I had one Kabbalistic teacher who told me that everything below Tifra in your experience is relative. Until you attain Tifra, you're unable to begin perceiving objectivity in life and the world. And below that, you have the experience that everything is relative and everything is subjective.
You know, that fascinates me because what this Kabbalist is really spewing in my regard is Black Lodge stuff. You know, once you become an adept, you will see that everything is fixed and you will have a corner on the truth.
I don't
know
if that's what he meant exactly. But if you also look at Crowley when he talks about nihilism, monism, and dualism, even Crowley says, up until once you attain Tifra and the Holy Guardian Angel, you do have the experience that everything is an illusion but this transcendental state. But then when you have Shiva Darshana, you're one with the many again. And then you realize that the whole Advaitist theory is bullshit.
Yeah. But remember, there's Atma Darshana and not Shiva Darshana.
The Advaita view is Atma Darshana. If you look up Crowley's 0 equals 2 equation chapter, and Shiva Darshana leads to the experience of uniting with the many. I see it as, if you look at Zen, they say in Zen, I won't even say Zen Buddhism, but just Zen on its own, they say, you know, the first major crisis of your work is that mountains are no longer mountains anymore. And then the second stage of your work is now mountains are just mountains again.
There's an interesting Zen story. A master and his Kayla are working in a field, and they're both carrying a large bale of hay on their back. So they're half slumped over because of the weight of the hay. And they're walking along, and the Kayla says to his master, tell me of enlightenment. What is enlightenment? And the master stops walking, puts down his bale of hay, stands up straight, and says, this is enlightenment. Then he picks up his bale of hay, puts it back on his shoulder, half slumped. They begin walking in, and said, this is after enlightenment.
Yeah.
Okay. There's much more in that parable than immediately hits the eye. Because the whole thing of the Tao, which is the mystery of magic, is that man stands upright. And the whole thing of our evolution is to stand even firmer upright. That we came from monkeys who were slumped over, and we stood up. We picked our knuckles off the ground. We're reaching for the sky.
Hmm.
And if you look at Liber Trigrammaton, the symbol of the master of the temple, you have the dot, the solid line, and then the broken line underneath. But the symbol of the black brother is the broken line and... I forget now which. I think it's the broken line.
It's
the dot, the broken line, and then the solid line.
Yeah.
It sort of shows the surrendering of the ego to spirit, bending your back to the spirit. Where in the white school, we don't bend your back to the spirit. We stand up to it.
But now in the end, I dare say that if one practices a superstitious faith to the point of a bhakti yoga, like some Christians do, you will reach enlightenment.
Of course.
Okay. So at the table of the adepts sits an adept of the White Lodge, the Yellow Lodge, or the White School, the Yellow School, the Black School. Okay? And they all three can wine and dine together and share a commonality with each other that is the same point of enlightenment. There's more than one way up the mountain.